All right, so I have an introduction to make, and then we will get started. But for those of you who don't know, we have a conversation for, 40, 45 minutes, and then we open it up to Q&A at the end. So as you're listening to what is bound to be an awesome conversation, please make note of questions that you have that you might want to ask. So anything that strikes you that you're curious about, write it down. If you're anything like me, you'll forget it. So write it down if you forget it. So welcome, and thank you for coming. I want to thank first Literati, who graciously hosts us once a semester, and we're very grateful for that. And Writer to Writer, just so you know, is a semesterly conversation between a Sweetland Center for Writing faculty, that would be me, and another U of M faculty member, that would be Jen. We talk about how our guests do what they do, which is they write, they publish, they teach writing in a myriad of forms. In Jen's case, they are also extraordinary filmmakers. And the goal of this is to offer students and other listeners a rare glimpse into the writing that professors do outside the classroom. So here, instructors from various disciplines describe how they handle the same challenges student writers face, from finding a thesis to managing deadlines, and I would add probably to imagining emotional conditions while writing. This series is also associated with Sweetland's Minor in Writing program. Any Minor in Writing students here? One, two, yay! And then hopefully some future Minor in Writing students, wink, wink, are here. And we hope that it's a valuable contribution to the larger conversations around writing that the university and the city of Ann Arbor and Literati sponsor so well. So this is our goal. So I want to introduce Jennifer Proctor, who goes by Jen Proctor. So if you hear me calling her Jen, that's what she goes by. Yeah, that's her name. She is an associate professor of journalism and screen studies at University of Michigan, Dearborn. And she's the co-founder and director of the Inclusive Teaching Initiative, EDIT Media. In this case, EDIT stands for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion in Teaching Media. She is a filmmaker and a media artist whose internationally recognized award-winning found footage work examines the history of experimental film, Hollywood tropes, and the representation of women in cinema. Her recent work in particular seeks to blur boundaries between avant-garde film practices and the scholarly video essay. Her 2018 film, Nothing a Little Soap and Water Can't Fix, which examines the bathtub as a feminized domestic space, won the Cutters Archival Film Award at the Ann Arbor Film Festival, Top Grit at the Indie Grits Film Festival, and Best Experimental Film at the St. Francis College Women's Film Festival, in addition to screening at more than 40 film festivals around the world. Her recent video, Am I Pretty?, appropriates the voices of tween girls from YouTube videos to explore the development of self-image and self-esteem in the modern era. In addition to screening at film festivals, including the Ann Arbor Film Festival, Am I Pretty? Appears in a special issue on audiography in a journal called In Transition, and the In is in brackets, the Journal of Videographic Film and Moving Image Studies. So welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thank you for being here when you could be watching the impeachment hearings.
Ah, yes. We'll try to be as salacious as those. So you're our first filmmaker in the Writer to Writer series, not ever, but that we've talked to in the Writer to Writer series. And I thought you were an especially exciting choice because of the ways in which our ideas of what constitutes writing have shifted and evolved in recent years. And this is not only in composition studies, but also in the larger public sphere. So in the Minor in Writing program, we've been challenging students for about 9 years now, I think, to think of writing not simply or only as words on paper, but as a multimodal adventure. So I'm really grateful to be in on your thinking about filmmaking as writing. So I thought it would be nice to start first with, do you pronounce it confound footage?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so confound footage is a thing that just came into being, and I'd love for you to talk about it so that everybody can be on the same page of where we are.
Sure. So confound footage is really just a DVD release of three of my recent films, but all of my films work with existing imagery and existing films in some way. So they kind of fall under the rubric of mashup or remix in a lot of ways, but they're really designed to take the original films that they're remixing or mashing up and reveal some kind of hidden truth, or take what is the subtext and make it the primary text of what we're watching on screen. And so in that way, like, I hope that it confounds the original texts and asks us to read them or look at them in a new way. So it's a DVD release. It's the first DVD I've made in like 10 years or something. I don't know if anybody even has a DVD player anymore, but some people have asked for it, so I made a DVD. So Confound Footage is just a collection of three of my recent films that are dealing with appropriation and other kind of found footage works. Mm-hmm.
And we'll come back to this in a little, like, near the end so that it's fresh in your minds. But we do have a flyer that Jen has put together that has some links of where you can find her work online as well.
Yeah, and most of my work is actually free online, with the exception of one film. But if you really want the hard copy DVD, then you can purchase one.
And the donation, or the proceeds, go?
Yeah, all proceeds from DVD sales and online rentals go to the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. And if you're not familiar with that, that is a fund to support people who are dealing with sexual harassment or retaliation for having come forward about sexual harassment in general, but particularly this was oriented to people who are working in the media industries and in Hollywood. It was kind of came out of the Me Too movement.
Thanks. So I usually start off by asking people what a typical writing or researching session looks like to them. And I wonder where you start when you're working on something new. Like, what kinds of things do you begin research on a new film? What kind of things do you do for that?
So my recent work, because it's built around existing films, so if I'm thinking about a film like Nothing a Little Soap and Water Can't Fix, which Shelley mentioned, which is a film that looks at representations of women in bathtubs from across different kinds of films, different kinds of film history, different kinds of film genres, different kinds of contexts in which women are in bathtubs. So that might be just like women in a scene where they're just kind of relaxing, women where they're just washing, women where they're crying and grieving, women where they're pleasuring themselves, and then you might imagine where this is going, but where it becomes a site of violence, where women are very vulnerable. So in that case, typical research is going to involve how do I find all the films I possibly can that feature women in bathtubs, which you know, relies in part on my own knowledge on film history, but then asking everybody I know to think of every example they can think of, doing search term, you know, or keyword searches on IMDb, seeing what pops up there, dipping my toes into Reddit, and seeing if people on Reddit will help me, which can be dangerous if you're asking for examples of women in bathtubs. So just kind of collecting all of that and then going out once I have all the titles and finding the footage. And then that becomes a kind of like taxonomic exercise where I start going through all the footage and then start kind of categorizing it. So this image of a woman in a bathtub means what? It's sort of conveying what, or it's what, you know, what kind of category, and kind of breaking it down in that way. So I start with... I mean, for me, it's kind of like putting a puzzle together. So I start with all the pieces, and then I'm not quite sure what puzzle I'm making, but starting with the pieces and then trying to determine how I put them together.
Nice. So you have a puzzle without its picture yet.
Right.
That's scary and exciting.
And there may be extra pieces and pieces that don't fit. And yeah.
Nice. So could you talk us through maybe... So Am I Pretty was featured in... the Michigan Daily and in the UM Record. And so maybe if you could talk to us about what Am I Pretty is, and then take us through your process of putting that together and how you wrote that into being.
Yeah, so Am I Pretty is an extremely visually minimal film. So this is a film where basically all you see on screen is a color. It starts with the color pink, a little bit of texture, and that color kind of eventually gives way to a kind of purple. So it's visually, there's not very much happening. What we hear on the soundtrack is... the voices of young women, tween girls, who had uploaded videos to YouTube primarily around 2012. It was part of a meme, and maybe some of you are familiar with this meme, but it was a meme where young women would upload videos of themselves to YouTube and then ask YouTube viewers to tell them whether or not they were pretty. And so they often would like tell a kind of a personal story, like, I don't think I'm pretty, you know, I'm getting bullied at school, and so I'm feeling really bad about myself, so I need you to be honest with me and tell me whether that's true. Or in some cases, you know, young women would be like, I think I'm kind of okay. Like, I think I am kind of pretty, but again, I need you to tell me if that's true. So I edited together the voices of these young women kind of sharing this experience, but then removed their images from the film. So it still is meant to be a film where it's asking us to look, but then it's taking away the thing that we're supposed to be looking at. So it asks us to think about our own judgment, our own role in looking at others and evaluating others. Mm-hmm. So I think about a film like Am I Pretty and Nothing a Little Soap and Water Can't Fix very much from like a writing perspective. And I'm trained, my undergraduate degree is in philosophy, and philosophy is really, I think studying philosophy is where I really learned how to write, because philosophy asks you to create an argument that is 100% based on logic and evidence, and to make your argument as irrefutable as possible, to make it as tight logically as possible. And that's what I'm striving to do with my films. My films are ultimately designed to create an argument about a condition of media, so whether it's a representation of women in popular films or whether it's a question about young women and their self-perception, but to create an experience that links those bits of media together in a way that creates an emotional journey, but also creates a critique or an argument about the function of contemporary media. So it's very, like, every time I edit a film, it's going back to this idea of creating a logically tight, cogent argument from a philosophical perspective.
Wow, that's really interesting too, because films are such an emotional experience, both in viewing them and I would imagine in a lot of ways making them as well. And so bringing to the forefront the logic of your argument is really, it seems like that would be a front load thing that you would be thinking about before you start editing together. Or how do you come to what your argument is? How do you figure that out?
Yeah, I mean, and that's an interesting process too. And I think this is what I love about the process is that I kind of start out with a hypothesis. So I have a hypothesis that there's a problem with the way women are represented in cinema, and that the domestic space of the bathtub is going to be a useful locus for that investigation. And so I start with that hypothesis, I gather all this evidence, and then when I start putting it together, I mean, I kind of test my hypothesis and make sure there's something there. So there's also like a little scientific method going on, I suppose. But then it becomes about this argument. And in the case of something like a mashup where you're editing together multiple examples of the same representations, it becomes an argument of accumulation, right? So if you see literally like the same image of women in a bathtub, literally in some of these films, the composition of the frame is exactly the same. It's a woman in profile in the bathtub with a wine glass. Like they're positioned exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And so when you have that repetition, it becomes, again, this, it conveys that this isn't just sort of a handful of films that are doing this, but that it's literally a formula or a trope that hopefully I'm revealing through the accumulation of this evidence. Mm-hmm. So it's through the editing process that I determine whether the argument actually holds water and I can actually put something together. But it's sort of, I mean, I think in that respect, it's sort of like writing a rough draft, right? You have to make sure that as you're writing your rough draft, you have all the evidence you need, you understand what you're trying to say, and you're figuring out how to say it and trying to determine whether you've been successful with that. And then look at your rough draft and kind of determine, like, did I succeed in this? Or do I need to go back and find more evidence? Or start with a completely different thesis. And so that happens for me in the editing process of a film.
Okay, so your rough draft. Do you ever storyboard these, or since you're working with found footage, does that look different than a storyboard?
Yeah, so I don't storyboard. It's more like taxonomic, where like I sort of am dividing things into categories and trying to look for themes and patterns and threads.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. And so a storyboard, for all of y'all who don't know, if you're not minor in writing students or not film people, a storyboard is a visual representation of the way a film will unfold over time. So oftentimes it's frame by frame or major shot by major shot, yeah. I guess, something like that. And we often talk about storyboard in the minor in writing when people are working on video projects or podcast projects or anything that is taking place over time. So it's really fascinating to me to hear a filmmaker say that the process is slightly different when working with a different kind of film, when working with found footage as opposed to footage you're going to go out and shoot.
Right.
Right. So that, wow. You drew my attention several years ago to a mashup about women and violence in Supernatural.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember the name of it, but it was over. So it was a mashup of several scenes from the TV show Supernatural. And in the beginning scenes, they were there was sort of stalking-like moments. And then later, I'm thinking of your accumulation argument. Mm-hmm. So later in the mashup, there were scenes of violence being enacted on women by men, and then enacted on women by other women, and then enacted on women by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that you're talking about your process of thinking about what footage is out there, I'm thinking about like the process that person must have gone through to think, how do I put this argument about violence against women in this show together? And how they got drawn to that. Like,
right.
What draws you to a particular thesis or a particular hypothesis?
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about that too is anytime you're working with this kind of material, it's emotionally taxing to go through this much violent material. And a lot of my work deals with violence. So I for whatever reason, I think I'm drawn towards horror. I mean, I love horror films in general. I like the feeling of being scared and like going up to being like just as scared as you possibly can be, but then like still sitting in your seat eating popcorn. And so I think I'm drawn to what that experience is about. And I think that there's a lot of gendered reasons. Like horror is actually a very popular genre for women. And I think it's because of the way that it often recognizes, unlike some other genres, the violence that is enacted on women in a lot of respects. And give some empowerment to that. I mean, there's the notion of the final girl is the hero of the horror movie, the one who lasts to the very end, the one who's understands who the bad guy is. She's the one that actually sees what's going on. So horror is actually like in a lot of ways a feminist kind of genre because it empowers these women to fight back against these acts of violence. So I think I'm really drawn to violence in representations. I shouldn't say drawn to violence, representations of violence in media in order for me to better understand how it functions.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it comes for me, I think, from looking at representations of different kinds of identities on film and wanting to understand better how they operate and then how they then reflect on us as an audience. But then I think it also gets very tied into my teaching. So I teach about a lot of these issues as well. And so a lot of my ideas often come from wanting to better demonstrate some of the concepts I'm trying to teach to my students. And then that kind of turns into a film in some way. Not a film that necessarily functions just for that purpose, but the kernel of it starts there.
Yeah. Do you ever have moments where you're watching something, say we have a shared interest in horror, right? So you're watching your gajillionth horror film. Is there ever a moment in a particular film that has triggered for you, I have to write about this, or I have to think more about this?
So this may be a strange one. So the film that I'm working on next is a film that is, So it's a specific moment that I was inspired by, which is in Aliens, which is one of my favorite films. And how many people have seen Aliens? Okay, so not everybody's going to get the reference, but there's a scene in Aliens that's always struck me where there's this one character, Bishop, who's actually like an android, but he's crawling through these air shafts, like on his, kind of like army crawling, And it's a really like unflattering shot of him. It's like uplit and it's like wide angle and really in his face. It's just like a really ugly shot. And there's lots of these shots out there. So there's lots of people like crawling through air shafts and things in various films. And so it got me really interested in just the thinking about images of characters moving through like the bowels of buildings, you know, like exploring buildings through the parts of buildings that weren't designed for people. And then how that could be kind of like, once I start editing that together, it can become this interesting sort of Escher-esque experience. And so that all started from that one image in Aliens, and then seeing so many other representations of that. And I think that there are some gendered elements to that as well, because it's like it's either men going through the air shafts because they're trying to accomplish somebody or rescue somebody, and for women they're always like getting away from somebody. Mm-hmm. So and again, like that's a hypothesis that I need to like look more deeply into. But so that would be one of the moments where I just became Hollywood is so interested in beautiful images, and that's just such an ugly image that I kind of wanted to know more about, like how that works.
Yeah, it'd be interesting too to know if it's ugly when it's men, but beautiful when it's women.
Well, you get more cleavage in the women when you're shooting from that angle, and so there is like that's something I want to investigate as well. Is like, what is that about?
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. So, see, just a tiny little thing can like pick up an argument or an interest in an argument. So how do you teach your students to compose in this way? Do you teach found footage composing? And do we want to talk about terms at all of like how you talk to your students about writing film?
Yeah, no. So, I genuinely, not just for the purposes of this talk, but I genuinely think about filmmaking as writing a lot. Part of the reason for that is, you know, I teach production courses where students are making films, but then I teach film studies courses where we're analyzing films. And film studies comes a lot of film studies is based on literary studies. And so we're using some of the same terminology. So when we talk about analyzing a film, we're talking about reading a film.
Yeah.
The term cinematography means writing and movement. And that's a term that came about from very early in film history. So it was clearly like that idea of using images to write was already kind of on the minds of early filmmakers. And so when we talk about in film studies about how we read a film, how we analyze a film, that also means we need to think about how films are written. Whose gaze is inscribed? Like whose perspective is always going to be represented by the camera, which is the same way of thinking about first person or third person kinds of point of view in writing. And then, of course, there's the idea of the screenplay, which is its own kind of unique writing animal, because it's so, and this is, you know, similar to playwriting, but it so deeply requires you to think about how to externalize or dramatize a character's interior thinking in a way that you typically can only do with like a novel. So how do you convey to us what a character is thinking if you can only do it by showing us how they behave or how they speak to somebody else? And so that unique element of writing drives all of cinema, right? Is how do we visually or through behavior convey an interior state? And that becomes sort of the wonderful challenges, I think, about cinema.
Yeah. Is there such a thing as an unreliable cinematic narrator, like an unreliable gaze?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's some great examples, but like one that comes to mind is the film Memento, it's a film that's all about unreliable memory.
Yeah.
And so you can never quite trust what you're seeing on screen, because the character, it unravels slowly over time, but the character sort of starts to realize that they can't trust everything. And so you don't know what you can believe. Or even something like Fight Club it tells us one story only to reveal it was a different story all along. So there was an unreliable narrator there. And I think we could probably, like, if I dug a little deeper, I could probably think of some examples where the actual gaze is unreliable, but there are certainly examples of that.
Yeah. So I ask that because I'm curious about how you can move your students from analyzing something that's been done to figuring out what they want to do in their own thing. Mm-hmm. So from analyzing to creating.
Yeah. Yeah. So I haven't gotten to do a lot of this in my teaching, but what I'm really interested in doing with students, and this probably happens a lot in writing classes as well, but is using what might be called deformative practices. So it's, I mean, in some ways, like, you know, maybe something like generating surrealist poetry or doing like an exquisite corpse mm-hmm. kind of assignment. But what happens if you take a piece of media and then start messing around with it? So slow it down. Isolate just one frame for every second and edit it together. Speed it up by 300%. How does that change the way you experience that media? Mm-hmm. And what does it teach you about how media functions? So if you just slow down an image, mm-hmm. that can radically change the impact of that image on an audience member. Yeah. And so what does that teach you about how media communicates? Mm-hmm. And that becomes a moment of both analysis and creation. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I'm interested in, is asking students to think about media in that way, which comes from the practice of just experimenting, right? Which I think exquisite corpse kinds of projects can do too. Like yeah. it makes you think about syntax and grammar, as well as what happy accidents can come out of multiple people writing a sentence together without knowing what yeah. one another is communicating.
Yeah. And so in a way, the analyzing becomes creating and the creating becomes analyzing.
Right, exactly.
So in Am I Pretty, when you take out the visual of the young women, you're focusing more on the audio and then on the ideas that you're evoking with the colors, right? Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. So do you assign traditional writing at all in your classes?
I do a little bit of, you know, traditional kind of argumentative essay writing and that kind of thing.
Okay.
But for the most part, I don't. There's always going to be something a little bit, there's always going to be either a creative element mm-hmm. that goes into it, and that's a creative element combined with analysis, or there's going to be like a multimodal, you know, multimedia kind of component, mm-hmm. component to what they're creating. Because I think it is bizarre that for so long, film studies has just relied on the written word to talk about film, even though video production has been accessible to us,
yeah.
like as consumers for decades now, mm-hmm. We've relied just on the written word to analyze film. And it's only now that we're starting to see video essay as a scholarly form
right.
take hold. So it's, yeah. it's bizarre to me. Like I think it's important for students to be able to write about imagery, mm-hmm. But I also think it's important for them to be able to use imagery as an element of their analysis.
Absolutely. How would you define a scholarly video essay? Like, what does that mean to you?
So the scholarly video essay, it's on a spectrum, I think. And so one is that it is a video that takes the form of something more like what we would consider a traditional essay. So we maybe have a voiceover, we're looking at imagery of a film that's under analysis, and the voiceover is telling us something analytical and thoughtful mm. and brilliant about what we're seeing on screen, and then using the actual images from the film as illustration and evidence mm. for the analysis. So that we're literally, like we're able to like literally point at the example that the author is talking about, mm-hmm. Which is not what happens when you're just, you know, reading a journal.
Right.
But I like to argue, and I'm grateful that the scholarly video essay community has embraced my work as being also part of this spectrum of scholarly video essay, where if the film is enacting a critique of existing material in a way that is, you know, rich and has depth and can be written about, I suppose, then that can constitute a scholarly video essay as well.
Yeah. So that there's a mashup in between. So you wouldn't necessarily separate creative from academic.
No.
I'm using scare quotes.
Because, yes. Yeah. No, I mean, for me, they're very much fused.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you want to talk a little bit about edit before we move on? Because I remember when you like floated this idea out there, and now it's a whole thing. And so if you could talk a little bit about what it is and how it can be useful to students, to professors, to anyone.
Yeah, so Edit Media, which again stands for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion in Teaching Media, is an initiative that I co-founded with a number of other faculty in film programs around the country, as well as a number of students, that is designed to promote best practices for inclusive teaching in film programs. And this came out in part because of the Me Too movement. And like you may have heard that Hollywood has some diversity issues. And these continue, they persist. You know, we might see a few peaks where we see more female directors and more directors of color, you know, making more films and being recognized in, at the Academy Awards, and then Hollywood kind of pats themselves on the back and things go back to normal. And so this initiative kind of grew out of that and recognizing that some of the problem that affects Hollywood starts in our film schools, right? That in a lot of ways we replicate the same problems that are happening in Hollywood in our film schools and don't necessarily prepare our underrepresented students to go into an industry that has traditionally been kind of hostile to them. So this is about trying to work on that problem from the level of higher education and do better for students of underrepresented identities in the way we teach film and empower and enable them to go into the industry and start affecting change there as well. And not just, you know, not just our underrepresented students, but also our, you know, more mainstream students to get them involved as allies in kind of upending the system.
Yeah. And so I'm really in love with the idea that students are a part of this initiative. And I wonder if there are ways in which you go about in your teaching continuing to bring students into this, and if there are ways in which other people could continue to bring students into this.
Yeah, I mean, I try as much as I can to bring students into the fold in terms of helping to do research. And we have a database of teaching materials that any instructor can use that I think they're designed more for film faculty but aren't exclusively of use to film faculty. Mm-hmm. So clips of from films that feature diverse filmmakers or diverse casts. And so I try to bring students into the fold in helping us collect that material. Yeah. We're trying to move forward, but we're a small and scrappy crew at the moment and working on getting more funding. And it is important to me that students who work for the initiative get paid. And so that's something that I'm working on as well, is to make sure that any students that we have coming into the fold are getting some kind of compensation for their work. Right. So we're working on that.
Nice. So what is your favorite kind of project to assign that would ideally generate the kind of intersection of analysis and creative output and critical thinking? Like, do you have a go-to that is kind of your favorite? This is going to generate really interesting writing in multimodal ways?
So that's interesting. So I think one of the assignments that I really enjoy, and I like really enjoy reading, is an assignment in a course I teach called Gender, Sexuality, and Power in Screen Studies, which is really just a course that's all about representation. So representation of gender, you know, masculinity and femininity, and intersections with other aspects of identity. And so what I ask students to do at the end of the semester is take a film that they think has some problems with representation and reimagine it so that those representations would become positive and progressive, which is tricky. And it's tricky not to just sort of just reverse, you know, it can't be as much as a gender reversal, right? That doesn't necessarily solve the issue. So that's one that can take lots of forms. So it could be that the student pitches, like creates a video where they're pitching their idea. It could be that they create a multimedia essay where they write about their reimagining and then include images that support their idea. In some cases, students will do remixes or mashups or a video essay where they, you know, they look at an existing film and say, here's a scene that's a problem and here's how what it would look like if I were going to redo it. So like Grease. A number of students have done Grease, which I think has been just like fantastic. It's I, I Grease is one of those films that I just kind of saw as a kid and just sort of accepted it. And then once my students brought it to me and was like, look at all these problems. And like, here's how I'm going to fix it. Yeah. It's been great. So that's one where I give them a lot of leeway in terms of how they present it. Mm-hmm. But they're having to be creative in reimagining this film, but then root their ideas in the theories and concepts that we've studied during the semester. Mm-hmm. And so it functions on all of these levels. And they're usually just so fun to read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's the revision process like for those? Like, do you, so, you know, in a traditional essay, say you might assign like an annotated bibliography and then a, you know, a rough draft and then a revised. So what's that process like for your students?
Yeah. So I'll say, there's not a lot of revision that happens on this one. And that's partly just because in this class, there's not a ton of room for revision. They have the opportunity always to submit a rough draft and get some feedback. Mm-hmm. But the expectation is kind of by the time that we've gotten to this particular essay, they've been scaffolded mm-hmm. with other assignments along the way that have led them to this point. And then this is a moment that's just a little bit free. So I don't worry too much about revision with this. Yeah.
Because it sort of happens along the way, it sounds like. I mean, they're tweaking their ideas as they go and getting feedback. Yeah. That's so exciting. So being conscious of time, I thought it might be useful to work through our cribbed Inside the Actor's Studio rip-off list of questions and then turn it over for Q&A to our audience so that they have a little bit of time to ask you things that might be on their mind. And I don't know if you're someone who decided to read them ahead of time or who decided not to.
I've read some of them and then some of them I didn't, so we'll see how this goes.
Okay. It's about 50-50. Like half of our guests want to know what the questions are and then half of them are like, just bring me cold, and then they get upset with themselves for going cold, so we'll see. But Jen's really good on her feet, so okay. So if anybody has ever watched Inside the Actor's Studio, this is like that Proust questionnaire that they ask at the end where it's a list of questions. Every guest gets the same. So what's your favorite word?
And I did note that you, I think Inside the Actor's Studio, they asked what's your favorite curse word, and I noticed you made it a little bit more PG.
Yes, yeah. I did. For radio.
So I think I decided that my favorite word right now is chonker, because I love internet language, and you know, chonker refers to particularly rotund cats and dogs. So that would be a chonker, and then floof is also one of my favorite ones.
It's a great word.
It's just sort of any sort of furry, lovable thing.
Yeah.
So chonkers and floofs, those are kind of my favorite things.
Nice.
Right.
I love that those are both visual, too.
They are, yes.
So I want
to poetic in some way.
Yeah. And so I want to do like call an audible, and I want to ask you what your favorite visual image is. And that might be a trope, or it might be just any visual that always stays with you.
Oh, my favorite visual image. That's a really hard one. It's definitely easier to think of visual images that I hate.
Okay, do that.
Visual images that I love.
Yeah, what do you hate?
So, I was recently in the Galapagos, which was amazing. And actually, that is just, like, that is a place that is full of just incredible visuals. But a friend of mine was also just recently there and sent a picture of a giant centipede that had been smushed. And it made me so grateful. I did not see a giant centipede while I was there because I think it would have ruined everything. So she said that one of her shipmates, she did a cruise in the Galapagos, actually had a picture of a giant centipede eating a snake. And so this picture of the giant centipede, like basically centipedes, I think, basically is what I'm trying to say. Ooh. Like, I don't like anything with that many legs.
Yeah.
And if it's smushed, even worse.
Oh. I might never sleep again. So what's your least favorite word?
You know, I think my least favorite word, I came up with PFAS.
What does it mean? It's on signs everywhere.
It represents something terrible. I don't like the acronym. I don't like the way it sounds.
Yeah.
And I could do without hearing it for a while. Ideally, because it's all been cleaned up and our water is all safe.
That would be ideal. So what is your like favorite overused word that you use anyway?
Oh.
And floof might be one of those, but, you know,
I don't think
that
could be overused.
Yeah.
Fair. that I... So, okay, I clearly didn't read through all of these questions and think about them enough. I mean, I think I probably use like a lot and don't mean to, but it works its way in there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it bothers me, sometimes it doesn't. But it's, you know, it's an overused kind of filler word that I use anyway.
And linguists say that it's actually a really great overused filler word.
Okay.
Because it allows our brains time to process our thoughts.
Exactly, right? I mean, it's sort of better than other kinds of filler words.
Yeah.
It's kind of better than
It's way better than
I'd rather have like.
You can inflect like.
Like.
Yeah.
Yes.
What thrills you, and I'm going to say as a filmmaker... And as a film viewer?
What thrills me? Mm-hmm. I think what thrills me as a filmmaker, well, so I think what thrills me as a film viewer is those moments, you know, those moments when a film can give me goosebumps. And maybe, I don't know if that happens for everybody, if a film gives you goosebumps, but that moment when something on screen is so immersive, like you're so wrapped up in the characters, you're so wrapped up in the world, and it's rapturously beautiful to watch, and the sound is just washing over you. Mm-hmm. And so the whole movement, you know, the whole moment in a movie theater is just like triumphant. You know, it's just that you're being transported literally by a story. Mm. And so I think those are what thrills me as a film viewer.
Yeah.
I think what thrills me as a filmmaker, I think what I love about working with found footage is that I'm using other people's creations, and that makes it easier for me to watch my own films over and over again when I have to, you know, like they show in a film festival and it's like I have to be there and watch it again. But I kind of love that because I'm constantly being exposed to someone else's work and appreciating somebody else's work in a new context.
Yeah.
And so it's that collaboration, like it's that hidden collaboration that I'm having with all these other people that created all these other films who don't know that they're collaborating with me, but that we've created this thing together.
It's a larger conversation that's coming to life in front of you.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I want to put a pin in an idea, so help me remember this, because I want to think about how you cite when you're doing found footage and so how you acknowledge that invisible collaboration that comes later, because I think that's really useful. What repels you as a filmmaker and as a viewer?
As a viewer, I really don't like saccharine sweet. I don't like happy endings, but I especially don't like saccharine sweet happy endings that feel manipulative in some way. And so I've been watching a lot of Schitt's Creek. I don't know if how many of people watch this show. It's the sweetest, most sincere show. Like I love just how genuine it is without ever crossing that line into saccharine. And so I think that's a show that's doing that really well. And I keep worrying, like, is it going to go there? And then it doesn't.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that repels me. And as a filmmaker, I don't want to do that either. And not that my films really risk doing that, but I think
there's nothing sweet about violence.
Yeah, there's nothing like I can't quite do that. But I think there's, I think what repels me as a filmmaker is crossing over into making something that's actually shallow, you know, that where maybe I think there's depth, but it turns out it's really shallow. Ooh. I think I'm always worried about that.
Yeah. I imagine that's especially true when you know that for you, your films are making some sort of argument, and you might worry that, is this argument being hammered into someone's face instead of being...
Yeah, is it being hammered in, or am I just stating something that's so obvious that people are going to roll their eyes?
Yeah. The curse of expertise. who's filming or composing style other than your own would you like to attempt?
Yeah, well, so I remade another filmmaker's film a few years ago. This was a film by a filmmaker named Bruce Conner, and his film was called A Movie. And so I made a remake called A Movie by Jen Proctor. but it was fantastic because it was almost entirely a shot-for-shot remake of his original. So I laid down his original film, which was made in 1958, and it was a found footage film that was made of like novelty films and newsreels and things like that. And then I found images on YouTube and LiveLeak from 50 years later and sort of laid them over shot by shot. And so it brought me into his editing style, and really challenged my own instincts for how I would edit something together. And so, I'm answering your question sort of in the past, but that was an amazing experience to get inside another filmmaker's head and how they might pace a film differently from the way I would. And then I get to sort of borrow their skills. So that was a great one, Bruce Conner.
Awesome. Has that stuck with you and shown up in other places in your work since then?
I'd like to think so. Yeah. I don't know for sure, but it definitely it made me think about things in a different way when I made it.
And whose filming or composing style other than your own would you say, nope, never, not doing that?
Michael Bay. Probably Michael Bay can do his thing and I'll do my thing. Uh-huh. And
no slow-mo explosions for you?
Not intentionally, yeah.
Okay. And then what three or four writers or filmmakers or all of the above would you invite to your ideal workshop or retreat?
So I was thinking about this, and I think one of the first people that came to mind was Peter Schaefer, the playwright. Hopefully I'm remembering his name correctly, who wrote Amadeus and Equus, who I think is just a brilliant dramatist, and a brilliant dramatist of characters who are tormented.
And making the internal external.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So I thought of him, I thought of Laurie Anderson, who's, again, a multimodal kind of person, performance artist, musician, actress, literal, physical performer, who's thinking about writing in all these different ways. She's a beautiful lyricist. So I thought about her, and then there's another performance artist, filmmaker named Miranda July, who's just sees the world in a very unique way, and again, can express it in multiple ways through films, through performance art, through feature films, through new media apps, and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. So those are a few people that I thought of off the top of my head.
Nice. And what I feel like I'm hearing from you there is when you want to get creative, when you want to challenge your work, that you're thinking about looking at people's work outside of what your normal experience is and outside of what you maybe already have expertise in, and you want to sort of challenge yourself
looking
at other people.
Yeah. And put things into new contexts and see what happens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's awesome. So I'm going to turn it over for Q&A, but I do, so as you're thinking, because no, it's coming to you momentarily, would you talk a little bit about how you cite when you're doing found footage films and how you credit?
Yeah, so Nothing a Little Soap and Water Can't Fix. So there's actually a couple things here. So Nothing a Little Soap and Water Can't Fix used over 100 films. And so if I had listed all those films in the credits, the credits would have been as long as the film itself. And so I just put a line in the end of my credits that says, go to my website if you want to see all the films that were cited here. And then my website has a huge list of films. So I was careful to cite all of those films because I think there's also a historical reason. People need to know what films these images are coming from. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, something like Am I Pretty, where I was working with YouTube videos by tween girls, without having any contact with them, I was concerned that actually citing them could be a problem. It could draw attention to them in a way that could be harmful. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, I didn't cite any of the sources. I have them, but I chose not to publicly cite them for intentional reasons.
Did you write somewhere that was a decision you had purposely made? And
I didn't write that, and maybe I should. People have asked me about it in Q&A kinds of things, but maybe I should make it a little bit more explicit that there was a reason for that.
Yeah, yeah. So, time for questions from the audience. Who has a question? Thank you. You stopped me from being creepy.
You can, on the next round. Okay. Feel free. So I'm curious if, I know that you said for the one with the girls, you didn't actually know any of the people who worked in the found footage, but I'm curious if you've ever been able to meet or collaborate with the people whose footage or works that you used. And if so, sort of what that experience was like, and if not, what it's like kind of having these invisible collaborators that you work with and knowing that maybe they'll never know that you're working on something that uses things from their life.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've thought about that a lot with Am I Pretty, with these young girls. And there's a part of me that's wanted to reach out to them, and especially to see, like, where are you at now? You know, like, what's happened in the past few years? Do you see yourself in the same way? So that one, I think I feel comfortable about having used their voices. I feel like I've given respect to the experiences that they shared. But I'm also aware that... that I've done it without their knowledge. And so I always want to be conscious of the ethics involved in that kind of a collaboration. So I have done a little tiny bit of work where I've worked with other people whose work I was appropriating. And for the most part, those have been good and like productive and respectful kinds of things where we were on board with one another from the beginning. But in terms of like working more with Hollywood films, I mean, part of me is just like, I don't care what they think. And at the same time, it's the only thing I really worry about there is copyright issues. Like I feel very comfortable that I'm working legally within the fair use exception to copyright law by using the material in the way I do. But there's always the danger that I get on the radar of somebody whose radar I don't want to be on, and they get upset about it. So, but when it comes, it becomes a power issue, right? Where I don't have an issue working with Hollywood films in the way that I do and critiquing the heck out of them because they have a lot of power. Like, they have a very loud voice, and I'm trying to speak up against that. Whereas the young women on YouTube, they're disempowered from the point of view that they're expressing. And so I want to be careful about how those power relationships are negotiated and how I fit into those power relationships as well.
Other questions?
Shelley pops up in the back.
Oh, Donald. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Donald.
So I'm curious your process for revision and feedback. If it's the same, does it depend on a project? Do you have trusted advisors? Do you do test screenings? How do you involve others, if at all, to sort of move through that revision editing process on a project?
Yeah, that's a great question too. And I think in the past I used to just like finish a work and then feel like it's done and move on. And now I've become much more open to the idea of returning to a work until I feel like it's really right. So I do have some trusted advisors that I'll usually send out a rough draft to, and they've been really helpful. I mean, one of them, it was because of his feedback that the ending of a film changed, and that was really, it was a really important change. So I do have people that I send out because I think any of us who, you know, create anything know that you can get too close to the thing that you're working on and not be able to see it anymore. And so you need somebody else who can, you know, speak frankly to you. And so then I'll come back to it. But I wouldn't even say that I necessarily even have test screenings. But even if a work goes out into the world and I see that it's landing in a certain way with audiences, I've become less worried about going back and making some tweaks and then sort of re-releasing the newer version, even if it's supposedly finished and already out in the world. So I do like pay attention and listen to audience reactions. Are they laughing in the right places? And if they're not, is it because of them or is it because of my film?
Nice. Emma, you had a question, right?
So you talked a little bit about how you, through your writing process and through your filmmaking process, you create a hypothesis, and then through your research, you kind of do a little bit of experimenting and see if your hypothesis actually rings true. And I was kind of wondering if you could give an example of a time where your hypothesis didn't hold to be true, and then how you kind of went about correcting your hypothesis, and then how that kind of felt. We're kind of doing that, and our class right now a little bit. Just wanted to get your feedback on that.
Might be getting a little useful feedback on an assignment here. Yeah, that's a good question. Oops. I mean, I think I'm like with the idea that I mentioned of that I'm working on right now, where I'm looking for images of people crawling through buildings and things. I have this idea in my head of what I think that's like, that I think that I'm going to be able to piece all these different shots or scenes together into a larger work that makes sense. And this, I'm in a stage right now where I don't know if that's going to be true. And so I'm gathering the footage right now, and then it's going to be a question of when I start putting this footage together, these images together, do they actually fit? Does it actually tell a story? Does it actually reveal anything about architectural space and gender and things like that? So that's an example where I'm still exploring the hypothesis, not that the hypothesis has necessarily gone wrong. I would say for me, what usually happens is if I start with a hypothesis and then I start looking for footage, I'll just discover that I can't find enough of the footage that I think is out there to support the hypothesis. So it doesn't even get to like really the filmmaking stage. It just like stops short at the research stage, where I'm just like, okay, I thought that there would be stuff out there for me to work with, and I just can't find enough to make a film.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
Scott.
Hey, I have a question about Am I Pretty? I'm thinking about these videos that were originally made are soliciting a certain kind of feedback that must show up in horrifying YouTube comments underneath the videos, right? And it sounds like the way you've made this film, that part of the conversation is omitted, right? But I'm wondering if that is part of your process, like if that shapes the way you listen to the voices or the way you choose to piece them together, like if there's some like hidden, you know, like resonance from the omitted conversation that you would know shows up in the film, even if someone watching it wouldn't.
Yeah, that's interesting. I did reach a point. Those were really difficult films or videos to watch. You know, watch all the way through and like dozens and dozens of them. I will say, at a certain point, I stopped even looking to see if there were comments because I couldn't stomach that. I know, like in quite a few of them, those videos had only gotten 3 or 4 views ever. So there were no comments. Like a lot of them had no comments. And so I was grateful for that. But there were a handful that had some terrible comments. I'll say I didn't take those comments so much into consideration. Again, I just sort of tried to not even acknowledge them as I was looking for the videos. But the knowledge I did have was about the visuals. You know, like I knew what these young women look like. I knew what their bedrooms look like. I knew what their like brother in the background look like. Their cats, you know, like, and their rooms are spectacular. You know, like tween rooms, like they, as to the extent that they're talking about their own self-doubt, you wouldn't tell that from the way that their rooms are just plastered with their own identity. You know, posters and stuffed animals and like all the stuff that they love. And so that was the hardest for me, is knowing what they look like, trying, because I can't unsee that. Even as I'm editing their voices, like as soon as I hear their voice, I know exactly which girl it is. And so that was the biggest challenge, was like trying to divorce the image from the voice for myself as a filmmaker when putting it together. And I will say, like as heartbreaking as a lot of those videos were, I tried, there's definitely moments in those videos where the confidence and self-appreciation really comes out, where they might be talking about self-doubt, but then they crack a joke, or they start singing, or they start talking about their favorite band, and so their personalities really shine, and I tried to give voice to those elements of these young women as well, as a way of kind of acknowledging the visual that we can't see that was really wonderful in the backgrounds.
So we have time maybe for one more question, if anybody wants to ask one more. Okay, perfect, because we kind of didn't have time for one more question, but I didn't want to shut anyone down if they had one. So anyway, thank you, Jennifer, so much for coming and talking to us
thank
about
you
your process.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Shelley Maness, for a wonderful interview.